In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about an issue that we certainly have discussed before, although not in some time, and that is the use of Native American images, symbols, names, words by sports teams. It has been an issue that has been up for debate in this community off and on for at least for the past few years, although nationally it's not really a new issue. It's something that has been discussed and debated for about 30 years across the country. And as a result, many teams in colleges and universities have stopped using American Indian names and images for their sports teams, among them Dartmouth, Marquette, Stanford, the University of Oklahoma, University of Southern Oregon, Eastern Michigan, St. John's, the largest Catholic university in America, Miami of Ohio, and many, many high schools as well have done the same. Literally hundreds of schools have made the decision to do this. However, activists in this area continue to raise the issue because there are still many schools who use them. Professional sports teams use them. And it is an issue that from time to time we think it's worth discussing. And we will be doing that here this morning with someone who has been involved in this for some time. Negon Nwewedan is one of the founders of the American Indian Movement as director of AIM. He is also involved in an organization called the National Coalition on Racism in Sports and the Media, which is a group of people across the country that has come together really to discuss the issue, to raise the issue, and to try to persuade schools to not use Indian mascots anymore. Our guest was a major figure in the occupation of Wounded Knee back in 1973. He played a founding role in the International Indian Treaty Council. He's also directing the Peacemaker Center for Indian Youth and the AIM Patrol, which provides security for the Minneapolis Indian community, and also is an organizer, as I mentioned, of the National Coalition on Racism in Sports and the Media. He's here on the U of I campus to talk about the issue, to talk with students, and in fact, if you are interested, he will be talking on this topic tonight at 7 o'clock at the Illinois Disciples Foundation. That's at the northwest corner of Springfield and Wright. And I'm sure that anyone who is interested in attending would be welcome. And of course, questions, comments are welcome here on this show. All you need to do is call us. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point, all we ask is of callers just that they're brief so that we can accommodate as many different people as possible. But anybody is welcome to be a part of the conversation. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Good morning.
We appreciate it. This is something that, you know, it has been talked about a lot here and on this campus for the last few years. And it seems to be something where even people of goodwill, or who would think of themselves as people of goodwill, people who would certainly would not think of themselves as racist or do anything outwardly racist, still, I think, have a difficult time understanding why Indian people are so distressed by the symbol of the University of Illinois. Maybe let's make it, localize it, and just talk about that, and we can talk about some other things too in other places. But let me ask you to talk about that. Why is it that you and other Indian people find Chief Illiniwek so upsetting?
Well, first of all, he's not an Indian. There's no tribe here. Most of the Indian people here in Illinois have been either wiped out or removed from their homeland. In order to wear a war bonnet or a chief's bonnet, you have to earn that. You know, no non-Indian has ever done that yet in our history. We don't run around with feathers in our hair. I come from a community in Minneapolis where there's over 30,000 Indian people living there, and I've never seen an Indian yet with chicken feathers in their hair or paint on their face and running around in some ridiculous Hollywood chant and dance and slapping themselves in the mouth and making some type of a war chant. So it's disparaging, it's racist, it's ignorance, it's if they reverse the situation, say for maybe they like to have honor the black people for a week or a month and see how black people feel about it, you know, and have a little mascot like black little black Sambo right? Call themselves black skins or Negroes or niggers, and see what the response in the black community would be. And maybe they want to call themselves the Illinois Kikes, you know, put the little, what they call them, little caps they wear, and religiously, and put a little propeller on and spin it around, and make disparaging remarks about the Jewish community, and see how the Jewish community feel about it. Or maybe it's just some, maybe a week they ought to just call themselves the Illinois Saints and wave crucifixes up and down, and have some little mascot dressed up like the Pope running around and sprinkling holy water on all the drunks every time there's a basket made or a comeback, and sing the Ave Maria for a war chant, and then get a response from the Christian community. Then maybe they would understand how us Indian people feel. They're not honoring us. You know, we don't want to be honored, if that's what they call honoring a people.
People who are concerned about this issue and would like to see the chief retired, make the very examples you give as a way of trying to get people to understand how it feels to you. And I think that people hear that and they say, well, no, it's not like that. It's not like that at all. They seem to feel that, you know, they hear you say that it is a disrespectful sham representation of real Native American culture, and that it's an appropriation of sacred symbols that to you are very important. And that's something that I think people just don't get, because that again they would say, well, but it's not the same thing. It's not like those other examples you give.
I think the reason why they don't get it, because they've never been taught anything about Indian people, their culture, their tradition, their form of government. They've never learned anything, you know. So most of America today still has this John Wayne, you know, kind of John Wayne frontier mentality about Indian people. And the reason why they have that is they're just totally scholastically retarded, you know, when it comes to Indian people. They've never been taught any different. Even, you know, think for Thanksgiving, or the only time they really talk about Indian people is around Thanksgiving, or when Columbus discovered America, when they celebrate that particular day as a national holiday, then they'll talk about Indian people for maybe a week or so, and then it's all forgotten again the rest of the year, except for the mascot. And it's very disparaging, because I've been to many games, for instance, with my son, or my grandson, when the Washington football team come to town, or Kansas City, you know, and I'm sitting in the stand, got a bunch of people that are drinking, and I don't drink, you know, and they're sitting by me, and maybe the Vikings will either go ahead or they'll be behind, you know, if they're playing football, and they'll, as they get drink more, they'll start making remarks like, massacre the Redskins, or kill them effing Indians, you know, and stuff like that. And my grandson or my son know that not only upsets them, it upsets me, and the first thing that they want me to do is move. Come on, Dad, let's go home. Now, why should my children have to be forced, you know, to go home knowing that there's going to be a confrontation? And it usually is, because I respond to that type of racism. I'll say something, and it usually ends up in an argument. The security is there, the police are there, and they either remove the people or find me a nice, better seat down below or something to get away with it. So a lot of our people wouldn't even go to a game, you know, when Washington or Kansas City or Cleveland or Atlanta is in town, because they know that that's the kind of fans that we have in the stands, you know. They just don't know. And they actually believe that. They actually believe that they're honoring us, you know. Well, we're calling you Braves, we're calling you Warriors, we're calling you Chiefs, you know. There's nothing wrong with those names. There's nothing wrong with those names. It's the behavior that it creates and the psychological effect that it has on Indian children, young people, to see that and witness that, you know, red, white, and blue chicken feathers in their hair and paint all over their face, usually their belly hanging out and a can of beer in one hand and a rubber tomahawk. And that's not a depiction. That's not a Indian people are a proud, honorable people, and have been since the first boat landed here. There's been over 400 treaties that have been made with Indian people, and every single one of them are being violated, as I said to you right now. Every one of those treaties, and they are legal documents. Sometimes they predate the very Constitution of the United States, and particularly the states that have organized and became states off of Indian land that was ceded to them. And those treaties are starting to prevail today. And the state of Minnesota, there's a treaty that goes back to 1837 that said the Indian people never give up the right to hunt, fish, gather wild rice, etc. There's just been a Supreme Court ruling less than a month ago where we prevailed. And we fought that for almost 30 solid years, and not only the American Indian movement, but the tribes that we were supporting. So there's just now an awakening as far as Indian people are concerned. We have student organizations like here at Illinois that are, you know, looking into Indian culture, inviting speakers. They have Indian studies programs across America today. And why do they have them? The reason why they have them is people don't know anything. They don't know anything about Indians, so they have to create these programs. And just the very fact that they created an Indian studies program, whether it be here at Illinois, University of Minnesota, or Berkeley in California, is an indictment in itself against the system, against the whole educational process, because this is something that they have neglected. And they try to appease us by creating a little program within the university. This is something that should be studied every day of the week. It should be written into every book and all the curricula, not just Indian people, but Blacks and Hispanics and Southeast Asians, other cultures that live here today. Instead of having Black History Month and Indian Month and now Southeast Asian Month, Hispanic Month, I think it should be written in. I think they ought to back up my own personal feelings. A lot of these schools, they ought to back trucks up and load all this bad curricula up and go dump in the dumps and rewrite it. And include everybody, be inclusive. If they want to talk about Indian people or Black people or Hispanic people or talk about cultural diversity, I think cultural diversity should go on daily, not monthly, on a monthly basis, 1 month a year.
We have a caller here to talk with. Let's do that. In Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I want to thank you for having the speaker here this morning, and I wanted to let him know something that is going on in the area that I think would be of interest to him. A local group called Women Against Racism has sponsored a contest for a mascot for the new millennium for the University of Illinois. Of course, it is not associated with the University of Illinois, and we're happy to say that we have received over 70, almost 80 entrance into our contest, and we're hoping to announce a winner on May 2nd, and we hope to present that winner on campus on May 3rd. And our whole thrust for this contest was to move forward this debate about the chief, to move it on to another level, to say that we are tired of it and we are going to present the university with another choice. And so we're looking forward to that, and we hope that you will keep in contact with what's going on with us locally. Thank you very much.
No, thank you very much. It's going to take groups and organized efforts like yourself and what you're doing to make that change. If there's enough public pressure, of course the name will change. There's no doubt about that. So I want to thank you for your efforts and hope that we can stay in contact with one another.
In addition to seeing the chief retired, would you also like to see the name changed and have no longer have the sports teams called the Illini?
Well, like I say, it's not the name; it's the behavior that's created by it. I don't see any problem with the Illini. You know, I think it's the image that's portrayed by the chief. What they call the chief is what's really bad, and we target this particular institution, the University of Illinois. I mean, when they come to Minneapolis or come to town, I mean, not only do we target, but some of the directors of the various sports programs in Minneapolis refuse to even use the name anymore or write anything about the chief. McKinley Boston, who is the director of the sports program at the University of Minnesota, said he wouldn't play any off-season games between the University of Minnesota and Illinois, you know, as to show his and their support, university support, for the efforts that we're putting forth.
You talked earlier about your personal feelings about not just the chief, but using names and images like the Braves, the Redskins that had been used by professional teams, and talked about your experiences of, attending a professional sports event and how people would conduct themselves. But I wonder, does this go beyond simply something that is a matter of hurt feelings or bad feelings? Can you make the argument that having these images is really bad for Indian people in a real physical sort of way?
Well, when we first got involved with this, I mean, on a national level, to really put some emphasis on it, was when the Atlanta Braves came to Minneapolis to play in the World Series against the Minnesota Twins. And we went into the public school system and the private sector, private school, and particularly Howard Ear Survival School. And we interviewed children from kindergarten all the way on and asked them what their feelings were about these mascots. Every single child was against it. We started interviewing people in the community, and we found out that not only the children going to school, but everyone, almost every Indian person in the city of Minneapolis was against it. And to prove it and to show it, I mean, when I was addressing a world a human rights conference on opening day of the World Series, and they were celebrating Martin Luther King and all that, and all these civil libertarians from all over the world were gathered there, and I was the keynote speaker right prior, like 2 hours before, about an hour before the game started, and I confronted them. I told them that Martin Luther King was alive today, he would suspend the agenda, and he would join the Indian people, and he would march on the Hubert H. Humphrey Dome and put a stop to that behavior. And lo and behold, they suspended the agenda. And they joined us, and within 1 week, we had a close to 100 churches, unions, schools, community-based organizations, all the way from the local to the National Congress of American Indians to every human and civil rights organization in the country joined us in that effort. We had close to 7,000 people march, and this all happened within 1 week. It's unbelievable how much support. And then, of course, the Creator blessed us because, 2.5, 3 months later, he brought the Super Bowl to Minneapolis. And as you know, the Super Bowl with the Washington team was there again, along with the Buffalo Bills. And by this time, we had over 10,000 people. So we knew that we had national support, that there are hundreds and thousands of people felt the same way we do. And it became an issue that was debated throughout the world. I mean, that it was on an international level where columnists and sports writers started debating the issue, and we were getting hundreds and thousands of letters and calls, not only in support, but those that still believe that they're honoring us. And I was right after the Super Bowl, I was asked to be on Sportsline USA in prime time. I mean, I'm talking like 6:30, 7 o'clock in the evening after the game ended. I was on Sportsline USA, and here was my opportunity, to address the whole world. They don't interview the Clyde Belcourts. They got the Elijah Wans and the guy that retired from tennis with AIDS, and sports celebrities, the Michael Jack Johnson, and big sports heroes like that. Not me. And I was on there, and I was going to be on there 20 minutes. I was on there for an hour and a half. And the amazing part about it, all the guys thought there was going to be a major confrontation. All these white racists and rednecks from all over America, the Archie Bunkers of America, would be calling in. It was just the opposite. Every single person that called supported in eliminating those kinds of names, and all these black symbols and Sambo's restaurants. They were talking about all these things are gone. It's the past. John Wayne's dead. It's time for America to let it go. They're making remarks like that, and I made that comparison to a Methodist minister out of Atlanta, Georgia, who called me and said, "Come on, Mr. Belcourt, there's more important things to do, than attack our baseball club. We don't mean any harm. It's America's pastime." He was talking like that, and I said, "Well, Reverend, tell me about those more important things." And the only thing he could come up with was the same old stereotype. "I think you Indian people, I'll do something about your alcohol." And I said, well, and gambling too, you don't pay any taxes. You got all these casinos springing up. And I said, well, wait a minute, let me tell you where alcohol came from. I said, we had no form of alcohol. We were the only living culture in the world that had no trace of alcohol. It was brought over on a boat. I said, in fact, I said, the Bible, the devil, and alcohol all came on the same boat. And look at the devastating effect. I said, yes, it is a tremendous, it's a national health issue for Indian people. But now we have our culture back. In 1978, they passed the American Religious Freedom Act, and we're using that purification sermon. Hundreds and thousands of our Indian people are getting rid of the alcohol, and Joel, oh, he cut me on right away. He said, another thing about these casinos, and you're making all the millions of dollars, you're not paying taxes. I said, wait a minute. I said, let me tell you where gambling came from. I said, the churches created that with bingo and their little casino nights and stuff. We didn't know anything about it. We built the casinos, tested our sovereignty. Yes, we do have gambling. In Minnesota, I said, there's 24,000 people work in the casino industry. That's where it started. And out of 24,000, 20,000 of them are non-Indian people that work and got good jobs and are paying their taxes. And then I went on to make that same argument with them, you know, about, well, why don't you call yourself the Atlanta Saints and the crucifixes. And once I did that, you know, then he changed right away. He became a supporter. He said, well, first of all, he talked about the great American family, you know. His wife was a teacher at cultural diversity in high school. I'm the preacher. My daughter plays the organ, and the other one leads the choir, the great all-American family. And then he started all this ignorance. I mean, by the time we got into the interview, I mean, it was obvious that this guy knew nothing, not a thing about Indian people. But after going through that conversation with him for about 5 or 6 minutes, he changed completely. He became an ally. He wanted to do something to put a stop to that himself. You know?
I'd like to reintroduce again our guest, Nigan Nowaywedun, is co-founder and executive director of the American Indian Movement. He is also directing the Peacemaker Center for Indian Youth and the AIM Patrol, which provides security for the Minneapolis Indian community. He is, in addition, an organizer of the National Coalition on Racism in Sports and the Media, which is an organization that aims at trying to raise people's consciousness on this issue of Indian names, symbols, images, and their use by sports teams. He'll be talking, by the way, about the symbol of the University of Illinois, Chief Illiniwek, tonight on the U of I campus, or just off the U of I campus, 7 o'clock, the Illinois Disciples Foundation. So if you're interested in hearing some more from him on this particular issue, you're welcome to do that. And, of course, questions here are welcome as well, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. I mentioned at the beginning of the program that this is something that people have been talking about for a number of years, for something like 30 years, a little more than 30 years, and that there have been many school systems, a number of universities that have dropped their Indian mascots and changed the names of their teams. Do you feel that, from your perspective, progress on the issue is being made?
I think tremendous progress. There's actually over 1,500 schools, colleges, universities that have made that change already. We had another recent federal court ruling that came out of Washington, you know, where they're not allowed to use the trademark anymore. And
for their football team?
Right. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they're appealing that, so they'll continue to use it until they exhaust all of their appeals. But there are several national organizations, the National Congress, American Indians, International Indian Treaty Council, the American Indian Movement, the Morningstar Foundation out of New York, and several other leaders that joined in that particular lawsuit. The National Congress of American Indians covers every Indian tribe in America, and they endorsed that unanimously and became a friend of the court in that lawsuit. So we have prevailed on that, and we have lawsuits going in Cleveland, Kansas City, Atlanta, particularly in Cleveland. We're targeting Cleveland because of Chief Wahoo. They have the Wahoo, you know, the guy that's teeth runs from one ear to the other, and red face, and a big, huge feather, and a little pinpointed head with a huge, his teeth are bigger than his whole head, and a little feather. We're targeting that particular team. the progress that we're making is we've gotten coalitions from the National Council of Churches that have a huge portfolio. You know, they pump millions and millions of dollars into these colleges and universities, and they do sponsorships, and they all have businesses. And so we've gotten them to join us, and they're talking about withdrawing sponsorships of a lot of these teams, and if they don't make that change. So it's starting to pick up on a national level. So we're making tremendous headway, not only in that arena, but names in particular, not only in the media and the movie industry, but for instance, in the state of Minnesota, they have several places called Squaw River and Squaw Point, and they use the name Squaw. Squaw is very, very derogatory to Indian women. It was used by the French traders when they wanted a woman for the night, and it was a name that there was used that had squaw within it. So what they were looking for was somebody to go to bed with, and that's what squaw means. It means a female organ. And of course, not knowing that, we have Squaw Valley today, and we have all these things. I mean, we are targeting those states, and we have had legislation that eliminated that in the state of Minnesota. We have legislation that's eliminated in Arizona, and we're just moving across to here. Country to get rid of those types of names. Right in the downtown Phoenix, they have Squaw Point. They have a mountain in town they call Squaw Point, and the freeway expressway that runs through the city of Phoenix is called Squaw Point Highway. So if they know what they if they wanted to be politically correct, you know, then they would correct that name and call it what it really is. And women, and you know, of course, women's organizations have stood up against that. And it's been the women that have really made that move. There's two young Indian girls in Minnesota that kicked off that whole effort. You know, 14 and 16 years old. They didn't like the name of the community they came from, which was called Squaw Point on the reservation. And they started to move, and the legislature picked it up and eliminated it throughout the whole state. So we're making tremendous progress.
The case that you mentioned with the Redskins is interesting, that this was a decision by the basically the patent and the trademark office based on law that says you cannot trademark or patent an image or something that is racist.
Right.
And they ruled against that. Now apparently that doesn't mean that the Washington Redskins, that doesn't say they can't continue to call the team the Redskins, but what it means is they don't have the trademark protection so that they can prevent someone else from making T-shirts,
right,
hats, whatever it is, using that name and that.
Well, it's all it is. It's an economic thing, you know. Like, yeah. When I was in Atlanta, we met with John Sherholtz not too long after the Super Bowl took place and the World Series left town, and Ted Turner invited us to come into Washington about Indian leaders and from all over the country. I happened to be chairing the meeting that took place there, and they said when Ted Turner bought the Atlanta Braves and brought them to Atlanta, he wanted to change the name right then and there. But the shareholders, there was a big thing, man. They were selling this Indian thing, you know, the tomahawks and the headdresses and the shirts and sweaters. And their argument was if they eliminated the name, that it would take them 2 or 3 years to phase it out because of the economics, you know, the chest selling of the sweaters and caps and tomahawks. I couldn't buy that argument because I knew that if they made their last run, you know, on a sweater or a T-shirt or a cap, there's no doubt the price of that sweater for $60 would go up to $360 or $260 because everybody would want it. So we understood then that it was strictly, you know, that it was a big thing. They're selling this Indian right here in. They do that right here in Champoint. I've seen toilet paper with Chief Lenowick on it. I've seen everything you see in town here, Lenowick, you know. They even put if they're so proud of the name and so proud of the chief, why do they put him on a piece of toilet paper, wipe their butt with it every day, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, God, where's their heads at? I mean, you know, there's something wrong here, you know, and it has to change. But anyway, I was talking to John Sherholtz, and it's a Jewish organization, and we weren't making much headway, and right in the middle of the conversation, he says, well, Mr. Belcourt, if you had all of Ted Turner's money, you know, And well, when I first started the meeting, they told us that we only had like 20 minutes, you know, to travel from all over the country to make our presentation, and we're going to discuss 45 minutes. The meeting was going to be all over it. So knowing that it was a Jewish organization, I talked about the Holocaust. I said, you know, we should never forget the Holocaust because it could happen again. And I went through, I told them every time I pick up a newspaper, radio station, television, movies, it's all I hear about. That's all I see. And then I switched and I said, well, what about the Holocaust, Indian people? 50 million Indian, there's still Jewish people here today. There's tribes that have been totally decimated. They're gone. They no longer, there's been 50 million Indian people raised from the face of the earth. And I went in and talked about the Holocaust to black people. That kind of opened up the whole thing. We were there for almost 4 hours that day. But right in the middle of the conversation, they were getting a little irritated. And he jumped in, John Sherholtz, who's the general manager, and he said, well, if you had all of Ted Turner's money, what would you name the team? And just like that, the creator gave me the answer, you know. And I told him that I thought it'd be more fitting to the culture here in the culture here in the Atlanta area, and what they've done to remove all the Indian people from this part of the country, and what they've done to black people, that they ought to call themselves the Atlanta Klansmen. And you gotta, you know, instead of giving out tomahawks, you can give everybody a sheet to wear over their head. And during the seventh inning stretch, I said, maybe you can have a mock hanging of a black or a gassing of a Jew. Oh, this guy, he just turned about six different colors. And I said, well, wait a minute. I said, if we had all Ted Turner's money and we bought this team, we would never dream, we'd never think about doing that to another race of human beings. But you had to shock him to get him to understand. Then he started talking about how Ted Turner wanted to call the team the Atlanta Eagles. He wanted to call the team. He knew, he could foresee that someday the Indian people were going to stand up. Hmm. And Indian people, he didn't like the name himself. He wanted to say. So I think we have some friends. And shortly after that, I got a letter about 2 months later from Ted Turner where they're going to run this 22-part series on Indians. You probably saw that, you know, where they depicted a lot of truth. In fact, he sent a team up, and I was doing a canoe trip from the headwaters of the Mississippi River to Minneapolis, 545-mile canoe trip. And that's where they started that whole series. They filmed that. And he wrote me a letter, and he thanked me for coming to Atlanta, and he was going to do this series and all that. And I wrote him back a letter, and I thanked him for all the considerations and appreciate our young people appreciate what he's done. But I said, it's not enough. The name still has to go. That behavior still has to go. So we're still on course.
Mm. Let's talk with somebody else. Here's an Urbana caller, line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I got a question. I was talking to some people who were like against removing the name and the mascot and all that, right? And I myself don't see why would anybody be against something that offends so many people, right? And I was the argument I heard a lot is like the revenues of the team would fall and stuff. Could you tell us if like the other teams that have changed their name actually seen a revenue fall, or what's going on in that market? Thanks.
We have not heard from anyone from Stanford to Dartmouth or any of the national well-known colleges that have made that change. They went on. I was just talking this morning with one of the students here that's sponsoring the organization that's sponsoring my being here today about a little team outside of Minneapolis who fought strenuously to keep their name. They call themselves the Burnsville Braves, and they have their little cheerleaders, you know, dressed up with buckskin fringed little tights on and chicken feathers in their hair and paint on their face and all that, and when the school board finally made the move, I was there at the meeting when they finally made the move to change the name. They left it up to the students to come up with a new name. I mean, it was bedlam. I mean, people were crying and screaming and all. And I stayed there for hours after the school board made their decision and talked to the students. And I said, well, you come up with a name. You come up with a good name. And you're going to still be a champion, because they're usually champions in baseball or basketball or football or hockey. And, you know, in the last 10 years, they have won a title, some title, almost every year. And 2 months later, there's a big article in the paper where the students selected a name, the Burnsville Blaze. and they're state champions today. Everyone, and everybody's happy. Everybody's excited. We have had other situations, like in Menominee, Wisconsin, at Stout State University, where the school board, I think they voted something like 13-2 or 11-2 to change the name, and the community, there was a backlash. The community came down on them. They kicked the school board members that voted in favor of that change off the school board, and they reinstated it to the Menominee Indians. I'm going to be speaking there next month, so there's still efforts to get them to reverse it again. So there are people that are holding on, you know, for dear life with these names and images and the stereotypical images that are portrayed, and don't want to make that change. But once they're educated, once they understand the effect that it's having on Indian people, it's they generally will want to make that change. So everything goes back to education, what our children are really learning in schools. You know, we all want to go campings and Boy Scouts of America, and I was those things myself when I was a young boy, and it's all based on Indian culture. But somewhere along the line, there after they get out of the Boy Scouts, it's all lost again. So it's just it's a matter of education. I think all of these names, there's no doubt in my mind that they will change. We even have black players, professional Hall of Famers that are joining us in this whole effort. People that weren't even allowed to play football, weren't even allowed to play basketball or baseball because of the color of their skin, you know, saying, well, they couldn't think they could never be a quarterback. You know, what about Randall Cunningham, you know? Of course, great athletes like Charles Mann, Franco Harris, multimillionaires, they're drawing maybe $5 million a year to play football, are now starting to join us in this effort, knowing that they themselves wouldn't have what they have today if it wasn't for Martin Luther King and others that stood up in defense and support of his athletes.
Not very long ago, within the past couple of years, I interviewed a woman, a Native American woman at the University of Illinois here, who was in the elementary education field, and one of the things that she has written about and has done, she's gone into schools, particularly where there are young children, and talked about Native Americans. And she said that she over and over again has this experience where she goes into schools and she runs into little kids who first of all think, well, that there aren't any Indians anymore. And they seriously ask her, well, how did you get here? Did you ride a horse?
Yeah.
And she says, well, no, I have a Mustang, or, well, I have a Mustang, yeah. I have a car, you know, it's out there. And they're expecting to see an Indian like you see in the movies.
I think we're still living in teepees and paddling down the river in a canoe. Sure. You know, they don't see us as a people, as a part of this diverse community that we live in today.
Well, what do you do about that? How do you educate people and know that this is, on the one hand, is a people who are very proud of their history and their traditions and are wanting to hold on to culture, and yet at the same time they're a modern.
Right.
They're a modern people, yeah. and that you can be both those things at the same time.
Well, you know, it all goes back to education. You know, I come from the state of Minnesota, and one of the books that they taught us about Indian people for years was called Minnesota Star of the North, and not even talked about our government, our tradition, the contributions that we've made, how we lived from season to season, how we hunted and fished, and what type of government we had. There was nothing. And it all started with the Lilco Uprising. It started with the War of 1862. And they didn't have pictures of Indians, so they would draw what an Indian looked like to them. You know, it was always, they always had us, the farm was burning down in the background, and the poor farmer laying in the field with an arrow on his back. The little baby's hugging the mother's leg, and the Indian guy's got her hair pulled back, and he's cutting her head off, you know, her scalp off. And we didn't have teeth back then. We had fangs that hung down by our chin, you know, and blood flowing off them. This is the way they depict Indian people, and this is what children see. Just the people, the adult people that are teaching and sitting on the school boards today and are the board of trustees or the regents of these universities, that's the kind of education that they have all had. And that's why I talk about this scholastic retardation, you know, that prevails in America and this John Wayne frontier mentality. What they've seen in those kinds of books, in the movies, is what they see of Indian people today. So the only way that that can, and we've done it in Minnesota, and it was Indian people that got that book kicked out. We helped. It was white students that had a book burning in a little town called Robbinsdale outside Minnesota. They all brought their school book to school, and they had a rally that night, and they burnt that school book up. It was 20 years outdated, and they were still using it. Not once did they ever talk about any of the contributions that Indian people made. They depict us as heathens and savages. In the state of Minnesota, one of our founding fathers was a guy named Henry Sibley, and the Indian people called him Long Knife because they knew nothing about scalping. It was Henry Sibley, and it was a governor of Kelm up in Newfoundland in the mid-1500s that invented scalping. You know, it became too cumbersome to bury the Indian bodies, so that's all you have to do is bring in their skull to collect your bounty. And they were bringing in baskets and gunny sacks full of skulls, and church ladies started speaking out about it and said, well, we got to get this changed. It's gruesome what you're doing to Indian people. So he put out an order to prove that you kill an Indian, that's all you had to do is bring in a lock of their hair. Well, most of us believe that Indian people were the scalpers, were the ones that invented it. We did it in revenge because we knew how bad and how the effect it had on us, you know. But in Minnesota, it was our governor, one of our first governors, that invented scalping, you know. So none of that has ever been told. None of the truth has ever been told. So where do we get it? We get it from the curricula that's not written by Indian people, not interviewed elders, or not interviewed to write these stories and change this history and talk about the contribution. Or we get it from the movie mm-hmm. industry, or comic books. Kids watch television. They watch comedies. Whether it be Mickey Mouse, whatever it is, the Indian people's always the bad guy. You know, they're burning villages down, or they're killing people all the time.
We're going to have to stop. I'm sorry to say, and we have some people we're not going to get a chance to talk to. But I want to mention again that our guest for today, Nigal Nwawedon, he is going to be talking tonight on this very topic at the Illinois Disciples Foundation at 7. So people who are interested in hearing more can do that. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you. And come out for the presentation tonight. Nigal Nwawedon, I'm the thunder before the storm. That's the meaning of that. Thank you.